ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
From an Ipswich fish and chip shop to the epicentre of Australian politics.
Please explain.
Pauline Hanson is making
One Nation.
This is the unlikely story of One Nation.
Well, I'm back.
Is it a passing protest vote or a permanent realignment of Australian politics?
Whether you love her or hate her, truth is stranger than fiction.
The Making of One Nation. To hear the full series, search for The Making of One Nation on ABC Listen.
Welcome to the greatest ever episode of The Mindfield. Famous last words, perhaps? Well, yes, but that's in keeping with the theme. Waleed Ali is my name. Scott Stevens is my co-host as we try to negotiate the ethical and moral dilemmas of modern life. Hello, Scott.
Hey, Waleed. It's a nice little setup. Ominous, given what we're talking about, but, you know.
Well, no, not ominous. It's foreshadowing. I suppose that is a form of something.
Ominousness?
Can only be ominous when it's foreshadowing. Yeah. All right. So we've decided to embark upon, what did we call it, an intermittent
series. Yeah.
Today is the second instalment of this. And I reckon we just dive straight in because I know that there's a lot to get to here and that you'll have a lot to set up and all of that sort of stuff. But maybe tell us what we're doing and why you chose it.
Well, this intermittent series is on last words, which may or may not refer to words spoken with a kind of endpoint in view, with finitude in mind. Words perhaps spoken with a sense of accomplishment or with concern over that sense of accomplishment. These could be words spoken in the face of despair. These could be words of desperation, that something that seems to be coming to an end needs to prolong itself even further. Or these may well be words that we go back and we look at differently in the light of what was soon to transpire after they were spoken. And I think everything that I just said probably encapsulates, probably is true of the words that we're referring to today. I should just say, by the way, that these aren't all words spoken in the face of death or with death imminent or death around the corner. These
So far they are. Conceptually, they are not necessarily.
No. Yeah. But this is what we're looking at today is Martin Luther King Jr.'s final sermon spoken at the Mason Temple in Memphis, Tennessee, on a stormy evening. And I think that's kind of important. It was a stormy evening on the 3rd of April, 1968.
Which he references in the speech.
He does. And can I just say, if people haven't listened to it, I mean, it obviously can be read. We'll include the link to the full text in the show notes. But it can also be listened to, because King himself spoke, in fact, without notes. This is one of the remarkable stories about the address itself. We might come in just a little while to some of the broader, both biographical but also cultural circumstances of the speech. But it is, I think, fair to say, Waleed, that at this moment, if you put together 1967 and 1968, King was at the lowest point of his life as a public figure. The large levels of popular support that he had received, that he could rely on as a form of political leverage in years past, these had all but entirely evaporated. Something like two-thirds of the nation viewed him unfavorably as a figure whose time has passed, as a figure who was perhaps impotent in the face of forces that he himself had unleashed, a voice of nonviolence at a time when there was a rolling series of violent protests, violent demonstrations that had racked North American cities between 1965 and 1967. There was a kind of irrelevance about his language, about love and beloved communities and turning the other cheek and embracing nonviolence and using soul force instead of pure strength. But I think one of the things that really capped it off in terms of public perception of King was his preparedness in the first half of 1967 to come out strongly against America's involvement in Vietnam. For those who were close to King, This dabbling in international affairs was counterproductive. It was a way of watering down the civil rights message at home. intermixing the civil rights demonstration with the demonstrations on the part of peace activists that were at this stage much more muscular, that were much more popular in terms of the sheer number of people who were turning out. This was almost a recipe to make the civil rights movement irrelevant in the face of that broader movement. But the other thing that was going on here, Waleed, is that, you know, and this is a slightly more delicate thing to describe, but I think it's an important way of describing it. For a great many Northern white liberals who were perhaps morally committed to the cause of equality, that were horrified by unequal and segregationist and discriminatory legislation, who were broadly in favor of King's message, and who certainly found King appealing insofar as one of the things that King did is he took away, he kind of cut diagonally across the dichotomy in which most Black American men had fallen into as either victims or as aggressors. King kind of cut diagonally across that and presented a much more expansive moral vision that wasn't purposefully alienating, that didn't necessarily require sacrifices on the part of most North white American liberals, but that was capacious. It was an expansive moral vision. And he did it characteristically in a manner that was patriotically and theologically inflected. In other words, it was a message that was spoken very much in that characteristic North American vernacular.
But Protestant vernacular.
It was very much a Protestant vernacular, absolutely.
So, and as such, was anchored in the founding mythologies of the American imagination.
Precisely, right.
So one of the things that's really, I mean, I don't know at what point we get into the specific text of this speech, or just...
Very soon.
Because really it's an encapsulation of his whole approach, isn't it? It's not just a speech in isolation, but one of the really notable things, especially reading it from the distance of today, is the extent to which it is appealing to the entire nation by calling on the authority of common reference points.
Yeah, that's right.
So that it's just so clearly intelligible to people beyond the African-American community, for example, because he's speaking, well, I'm not going to say their vernacular because there's a whole African-American vernacular, isn't there? But he's speaking their language, if I can put it that way.
The fact, for instance, as he begins the speech, he does a kind of historical panoramic survey of the highest moments in world history. He goes from Egypt to Greece to Rome to the Renaissance to the Reformation to the Civil War.
Yeah. When you say Egypt, what we're talking about there is the biblical pharaoh.
That's
and
right.
the deliverance of...
The liberation of the children of Israel from slavery.
Yeah. The children of God to the promised land, which, of course, has strong echoes to the theme that he's grinding out here. But I think we skipped over the nonviolence aspect of it quite quickly. I think this is an important point to emphasize, that his argument from the very beginning, and that is clearly present in this final sermon, is that the struggle is to be achieved via nonviolent means and through sacrifice.
Yeah.
And that it means that you will have to give of yourself with consequences for your job, for your school potentially, for your freedom, as in literally your carceral freedom. These are...
Possibly even your bodily safety.
Yes. Yeah. And, you know, there's a sense that he's foreshadowing. I mean, what he's experienced as well, he references when he got stabbed in 1958.
That's right.
So he's referencing these things. That theme is consistent. But I think what's interesting about his insistence on delivering this message at this time, as you say, the whole idea of nonviolent activism had fallen into some kind of state of disrepair. He's coming, he's been to Memphis before, I think twice before. He's there now in the context of sanitation workers' strikes, which of course disproportionately affect the Black American community. But he's there to try to reestablish nonviolence as a norm or as an organizing principle for this movement.
Yes. There's an important caveat there, but yes.
No, we'll go on. Give us the caveat.
All right. So just to take two quick steps back, I mean, it is probably worth trying to explain even just very, very briefly why it was that he was there advocating for the causes of sanitation workers. I mean, one of the dilemmas, I think, that the nonviolent civil rights movement had run up against is that it had proven very successful in achieving two remarkable pieces of legislation, both in 1964 and in 1965, the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act. And I think in the minds and for the consciences of a great many Northern liberal Americans, it was kind of like job done. Federal legislation is passed. Black Americans have pretty much what they've asked for. It didn't really cost us very much at all. Now let's, in other words, a degree of equality has been achieved de jure. Now we can just kind of get on with a certain degree of comfortable middle-class life. And I think what really struck King forcefully from 1967 onwards, after he did a number of important interventions in places like Chicago, notably not in the American South, was the state of squalor, of lived inequality, of lived indignity, of lived segregation due to white flight from black areas, due to a kind of de facto segregation of schools and shops and the economy. One of the things that King was forceful about wanting to capture is that what has been achieved in law now has to be achieved economically and socially. And that's why in 1967, 1968, he coupled these two things together. One was his opposition to the Vietnam War, because he believed that as long as America was bombing the hell out of that nation, as long as it was perpetrating a particularly egregious form of callous, senseless, and nationally supremacist violence abroad, it was never going to be able to address many of those same tendencies at home, domestically. The other thing that he wanted to address, Waleed, was what he would come to call the Poor People's Campaign. And this was, up to this point, most American citizens have not had to sacrifice anything for the sake of their black brothers and sisters. Now the point has arrived when, if we believe in the freedom that is accorded to God's children by virtue of them being God's children, if we believe in the principle of equality, and as he puts at one point, if we simply believe what has been written down, in other words, in America's founding documents, then the time has come for certain sacrifices to be made. So his final vision was to begin this Poor People's Campaign, which was going to gather activists, representatives from among the poorest cities in the American South, and to lead them all on a new march to Washington late in April 1968. And it was this trip to Memphis, Waleed, that was going to be the launching point. It's remarkable that he had tremendous opposition from within his movement. He thought that this economic turn was a recipe for failure. Many close to him believe that the tide in the nation had turned so dramatically away from nonviolence, that effectively King himself had unleashed a series of dynamics that other parasites were able to manipulate and then use. And I mean, one of the reasons, for instance, in this very address, he talks about an injunction that the city of Memphis had taken out against further nonviolent demonstrations. This is because 5 days earlier, a demonstration took place that began nonviolently and that ended up descending along the edges, around the edges of the demonstration, to window shattering. A 16-year-old African-American boy was killed. So there's something, I think, really powerful here. He's going to a remarkably poor and depressed city. In that city, he is advocating for, I think we can say without any degree of contempt here, he is advocating for the plight of those who are the lowest of the low, even within this remarkably depressed city. He is advocating for 1,300, he refers to them as sanitation workers. These are garbage collectors who were being deprived not just of anything like a living wage, they earned something like a dollar an hour, but they were also being denied the ability to unionize, the ability to have things as simple as access to showers before they return home. There were stories of maggots in hair, of stink seeping into clothing. So what King is doing here, Waleed, he is gathering this remarkable crowd that he initially didn't even intend to speak to. On a stormy night where there was a tornado warning not a few kilometers away, there were civil disturbance sirens going on in the background. Everyone was expecting a fairly modest turnout, if not positively depressed. And instead, he arrives And he speaks on behalf of, let's just refer to it this way, the lowest of the low. And yet he brings his full arsenal of rhetorical weapons, sometimes almost as a kind of riff. You can hear him having rehearsed these things before. But then at certain points, you can feel that there is a deepening of the rhetoric. You can feel that what might have begun as a kind of spiel, as something that he could have delivered in any setting and then given a slight tweak, a slight modification to accommodate this particular circumstance, you can feel him gaining urgency and power, perhaps inspiration even from the crowd.
Very well put. But I think it's interesting in that context that his appeal, particularly his economic appeal, is founded in a sense of power. A sense of power that is not appreciated by those who hold it. That is, the amount of wealth that does circulate within African-American communities. There's that passage where he compares it to the wealth of other nations. He says that it outstrips the wealth of, I think, all but nine nations.
All but nine, he says. And this is just the economic potency of Black Americans. Yeah.
Right. That's where I think the idea of the sanitation workers' strike becomes relevant here, because that is... Yes, that's about human dignity, but there is also an economic dimension to this. You mentioned that Martin Luther King Jr.'s approval ratings had kind of fallen. He was not a loved figure at this point in time. A big part of that dislike was also coming from business owners, particularly white business owners.
That's right. They would, in fact, say there's nothing civil about civil disobedience. Some of the rhetoric coming out of Washington was disrupting the ordinary function of businesses is criminal disobedience.
Right. And so here he is now standing in front of a Black American crowd, telling them that they are wealthy, telling them that they have power that they can wield, and encouraging a boycott on those grounds of certain companies based on how they treat their workers and so on. So there's kind of a redistributive element of this, but it's a redistribution not just of wealth, but of power and of dignity.
And but he also, he also says it's a redistribution of pain. He says, at the moment, these 1,300 sanitation workers are bearing the pain by means of a series of boycotts and what he comes to refer to as a bank-in and an insurance-in. In other words, boycotting certain banks, removing money from some banks and putting them in Black institutions, doing the same for insurance companies. He's saying that what we're doing here by boycotting, by this kind of targeting and strengthening of Black institutions, he says we're trying to redistribute the pain so it's not simply borne by these 1,300 people.
Right. Now, the banking in and the insurancing in is the interesting part for me.
Yeah.
Because it's not mere boycott. It's a redirection of capital.
That's right.
It's also about what is being built, what has already been built, and then what can be built further through investment into it. So shifting your money into Black insurance companies, for example, Black banks, these sorts of things, and the suffix of putting in at the end of these things, you know, obviously referencing the kind of
sit-ins,
the civil disobedience
that
occurred in the civil rights movement, the form of sit-ins and so on. It's an extraordinary piece of oratory. You're absolutely right. Watching it is something else, or listening to it is something else. And I challenge anyone to get 5 seconds into listening to Martin Luther King Jr. speak and not feel like something magical is happening. It's just the nature of the way he spoke. But it walks several incredibly important lines, I think. One is that in resisting the turn towards violence and speaking for nonviolence, he has to appeal towards one's sense of non-militant power, if you like. Mm. But he doesn't do that merely by means of calling for a destruction. He does it by means of calling for construction as well. Or the rebuilding of something that has already exists, perhaps. The renovation of it, maybe. It's ennoblement. It's enlargement, maybe is a better way to put it. And at the same time, all of this is anchored in common reference points, as we mentioned before, particularly Christian reference points and so on. The final line in it is that he's seen the glory of the coming of the Lord, obviously a very common Protestant Christian phrase. So there's that extraordinary bit in the middle, which seems a bit like a diversion in the text, I think, where he starts talking about the freedom that Black Americans claim, and that perhaps he wouldn't be surprised about these things or even necessarily calling for these things had he lived in a totalitarian regime, but that it was the precise fact that this was the deepest violation of the American promise that is in play here. And there's the wonderful passage that sort of we offhandedly, very deliberately and rhetorically offhandedly says, I read somewhere about free speech.
That's right.
I read somewhere about the right to protest for right. And so on and so forth, right? He can mention these things in passing in a kind of glib way, precisely because they are so canonical, they are so foundational. So by saying I read somewhere, the audience is doing all the work there. We know where, we know exactly how authoritative those things are. It's just an extraordinary constellation of, I don't know, should I say tools? Is that, or is that
yes.
cheapening it too
no.
much? This thing that veers between all of us and some of us, between ennoblement and power, between calling in and banking in and insurancing in and boycott, all of these things, but they're held in a really delicate balance. And I think there's something hugely instructive about that for particularly our time, where what we tend to see is more of a, if we're going to split it along conservative and progressive lines, and I don't know that's quite the right way to do it, but let's just do it for the sake of ease. It seems to be a battle between those who want to give nothing and admit nothing versus those who want to burn the whole thing down. Mm-hmm. And Martin Luther King Jr.'s approach just walks a really fine line in between all that. Maybe some of that is informed by the fact that his popularity has waned, that the nonviolent movement, that its peak or its energy, the moment of its greatest potency had passed in the public imagination and so on. Maybe, there's that comment that Stokely Carmichael, who had a far more militant disposition, offers, where he says that the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. was a tragic moment because he was the only one that the militants would listen to who wasn't of them. So he still had that kind of authority, but clearly it was declining. Maybe it was that sort of convergence of that what's rising and what's declining that meant that this moment or this message could be crystallized in quite this way.
Yeah, look, I think that's right. Before we bring on our guests, can I just say one quick thing about the overall architecture of the speech? Because I think something that's just worth pointing out here, King was depressed. Those who were closest to him heard him talking in terms of futility, in terms of an emptiness that was matched by almost a frenetic desperation. You know that those forms of meaningful action that are done with purpose versus those forms of action that are done desperately to hold off the encroachment of the night, if I can put it that way. There was something frenetic and unsettled about him. This very evening, he wasn't supposed to speak at the Mason Temple at all. He had sent his closest friend, who's referred to in the opening paragraphs of the speech, Ralph Abernathy, he had sent him there to speak in his stead, effectively, imagining that not many people would be there. When Abernathy then saw how many people, some 3,300, packed into a building that barely held that much, they sent word back that he simply had to come. He had to come. He was sick. So there is this sense that in the initial passages, he's trying to feel his way through his rough sketch of history, the historical moments he would like to visit as being moments of particular significance is kind of vague and at a few points a little bit silly. He wants to see the Roman emperors and see some of the things that are going on in the Roman Empire. There's some things
it's
initial.
A very offhand sort of, yeah.
I know.
The description of Egypt is like rich, and the description of the Greeks is quite rich. And then by the time you get to the Roman Empire, it seems like, I mean, he hasn't thought this through.
Yeah. Well, just, no, I think that's exactly right. You know, he says he wants to visit Mount Olympus and see Plato, Aristotle, Socrates, Euripides, Aristophanes, all assembled around the Parthenon. Well, okay, firstly, they weren't contemporaries. And then you can sort of move on from that. So you can tell that he's...
But his point is also, at least that phrase ends with that they're discussing some of the great questions.
That's right. You know what I mean? Some of the great and eternal questions.
Yeah, but that's a big deal. By the time you get to Rome, it's, I like to go around there.
But you can also see what's going on. At the opening, he's talking about being happy to be there. He's glad he is where he is, even if he was given the opportunity to live at the heights of the Renaissance, to live on the edges of or even within the opulence of the Promised Land, or, you know, in his namesake's town of Wittenberg. He would choose just a few days in the second half of the 20th century instead. He would choose to be here in Memphis because he keeps using this language, because there's something strange that God is doing. People are responding in a strange strange way. Things might seem dark, but it's only when things are dark that one can properly see the stars. All over the world, you can hear a common refrain coming up. People just want to be free. So you can tell that what he's doing in these initial passages is he's registering his delight in being there in Memphis. You can imagine him saying much the same place. The same thing anywhere he was. It's what bands do when they're on tour.
Yeah, yeah. Shelbyville.
Thank you, Simpsons. Like I said before, there is a bit of a shtick about this, but what he's also trying to do is to tell those who are here gathered in Memphis, you are part of this arc of history. You are part of this movement that began in Birmingham and that is now reaching a kind of culmination. We aren't at the end of a movement. We are in the middle instead. So there is an act of kind of rhetorical enlistment that's going on here. And it is interesting, Waleed, that having referenced mountains and being happy at the beginning, he also references mountains and being happy at the very end as well. In other words, you can kind of feel that this is a way of beginning and this is a way of signing off. But what's then remarkable is what he does in the middle. He goes from things that are quite vague to things that are very, very concrete. He says, effectively, there were times that, socially speaking, Negroes, this is the term that he uses, Negroes behaved themselves civilly. They laughed when they didn't really find the joke funny. They scratched where they did not itch. But then he says, those moments are over. We mean business now. And he's trying to say that there is a kind of moment in history that is not at the tail end of things, but is reaching something like a peak. This is part of a strange moment that God is working in now. And then he gives them a kind of list of things to do to respond to this moment. He says, we have to stay together. And that's because there was so much disunity in and through the movement. He says, we have to focus the issues on where the issues are, not the peripheries about who in fact was to blame for the broken windows 5 days before, but rather justice, and not just justice in general, but justice for the 1,300 sanitation workers in particular. He says that preachers who are involved in this movement need to stop talking about the vagaries of heaven, but rather talking about the practical dignities of earth as something that expresses the reality of the lives of God's children.
And the end of selfness. So the movement from thee to thou, right?
Yes.
You know, the story of the Good Samaritan.
Okay.
And he tells, which is, no, I'm not going to let you go because we've got to get to our guest, but I want to ask you just one final question.
Sure.
We actually haven't explained explicitly, I don't think, that he gives this address the day before he is assassinated.
Yeah.
And, I mean, the storm had arrived in a way. And he does reference this towards the end of his speech that, of course, I'd like to live a long time, but I'm happy now. And all I care about is doing God's work.
Yeah.
How live to him was the thought that he might be assassinated, if not the next day, then very soon?
Threats to his life were constant. Various aspects of his life were falling apart. That, I think, is one of the things that makes this particular rallying of a degree of soul energy towards the end of his speech quite remarkable. Because what he holds together, Waleed, it seems to me, is a nonchalance in the face of the prospect of imminent death. When he says, that doesn't matter to me now. When he says, I'm not afraid of any man. You can feel the inspiration behind it. You can feel that there is something about that that isn't just a shtick.
He means it. He's looked death, the possibility of death, in the face.
Because he can see, I think, he can see at this point that there is something to which his life has been given that needs to be devoted in the face of fear and threat, and that also has to outlive him. I mean, when he says, you will enter the promised land, I may not go over with you. Mm. There's no reason to believe that he hadn't embraced the prospect that violence, that deathly threat, was in fact going to overtake him.
Mm. And the Promised Land, of course, brings full circle the imagery of the children of Israel.
That's right.
Under Pharaoh, the mountaintop, seeing the Promised Land, all of those things. It's really coherently done in that way. All right. Let's bring in a guest, shall we? You're listening to The Minefield on ABC Radio National. Willie Daly with you. Scott Stevens is my co-host. Now we have time for a guest.
Our guest is our dear friend, a great friend of this show, and there's really no one we'd prefer to talk to about this man, this topic, this speech, than Stan Grant. Stan is a proud Royal Wiradjuri man, a theologian, the Vice-Chancellor's Chair of Australian Indigenous Belonging at Charles Sturt University. He's the director of Yin Yamara Nolowe and the author, most recently, of the book When Words Fail Us, Truth Beyond Time. Stan, thanks so much for being with us again on The Minefield.
It's always a pleasure to be with you. It's interesting, we're talking about Martin Luther King's last speech, but we're not talking about his last words, because there was a speech that he was meant to give that he did not get to give because he was assassinated. And the title of that speech, just to underline the despair, I think, that you've been talking about, both spiritually, morally, personally, physically, that he was going through, Scott. The title of the speech was Why America May Go to Hell.
Yeah.
Let me just read a little bit, because it does extend these remarks and puts it into a different framing, I think. And I come by here to say that America too is going to hell if she does not use her wealth, if America does not use her vast resources of wealth to end poverty and make it possible for all of God's children to have the basic necessities of life, she too will go to hell. And I will hear America through her historians, years and generations to come, say, we built gigantic buildings to kiss the skies. We built gargantuan bridges to span the seas. Through our spaceships, we were able to carve highways through the stratosphere. Through our aeroplanes, we were able to dwarf distance and place time in chains. Through our submarines, we were able to penetrate oceanic depths. It seems that I can hear the God of the universe saying, even though you have done all that, I was hungry and you fed me not. I was naked and you clothed me not. This goes to a real despair that you've intimated. And it makes me wonder where King may have gone, because you're right, I think, Scott, in identifying a man out of time. His ideas were out of time. There was an impatience among young black Americans. There was a resistance amongst white America, as you pointed out. Opinion polls say that 75% of people opposed him in the United States for various reasons. Where would he have gone in this despair with so much in flux? And I don't think that the speech, if you take away the prophetic nature of the speech and the end of the speech, which we will come to, where you see something else move in him, that is, I think, a supernatural force, I think the speech itself does not hold up. It doesn't age well. It appeals to a morality of reason. In his journey through history, he appeals to a Hegelian historical dialectic that will deliver you to some absolute spirit. As much as he despairs at American liberalism, there is still a belief in redeeming it. He's a progenitor of what becomes liberation theology, which sees that you can put a moral and ethical and spiritual force at work within the mechanisms of political liberalism or government that can redeem it of its worst. I don't think that has held up well. I don't think the moral arc of the universe is long, but it bends to justice, something that was said well before him that he liked to repeat, has stood up well. So there's so much in his speech, I think, in his appeal to a moral weight and a better angels of liberalism that has not aged well. And by the time he delivered it, was already superseded by other ideas that have gained momentum since then. So he was at a real crossroads, and we never got to see where King would have actually gone.
Can I just pick you up, though, on one point? I don't fundamentally disagree with anything that you said, Stan, but I think there is one moment in the speech that I find it's the moment that we've just gestured towards, we really haven't said anything about. But I find it stunning, precisely because King, at this point, moves from the architecture of government and legislation, and also the broad sweep of a kind of patriotic American, very much Protestant history that you just referred to. And that is King's reference to the parable of the Good Samaritan. I find this remarkable on two counts. Number one, when you listen to his speech, you know, what's immediately striking are the moments where the crowd is urging him on. Mm-hmm. You can tell those moments where he's wavering and they're trying to be the wind behind him. So those are the moments that are thrilling. But then there comes this moment. It's 14 minutes before the end. He says, let us develop a kind of dangerous unselfishness. Mm. And there's quiet. No one knows quite how to respond to it. And it's at that point that he then embarks on the telling of the Good Samaritan. I have no idea if he intended to at this point. But what he's actually trying to do here is to say that instead of the various forms of self-protection that are part and parcel of any affluent life or of any aspirational life, what's going to happen if I engage in this demonstration and I lose my job? What happens if I have to leave school? What happens if I'm subject to violence? At this point, King takes the vast sweep of history or the vast ambitions of the civil rights movement and reduces it to a person of another race hopping down off his camel and not giving charity by proxy, but rather being with the person, what he refers to as projecting the I into the thou. If I neglect this person on this road, this child of God, threatened by danger, if I neglect this person, what will happen to him? It's at this moment, it seems, that he abandons the logic of history and movements, and instead he says that what is necessary is a kind of aggregation of minute concern for the dignity and the well-being of those who are closest to us and those who are in most need of us. That, it seems to me, is the moral, it's the moral heart of the entire speech. And so when he says at the end, I'm not afraid of any man, you know, he says that the reason that the priests and the Levites passed the person on the road by is he suspects they were afraid. So I think it's this minute detail that abjures so many of the kind of the liberal sweep of history, so many of these grand movements. There's something here, I think, that is desperate, that is quite beautiful, but also that is so morally and personalistically grounded that it shrinks the world that King is trying to address. Mm. And it invites those who listen to him to do so similarly in the face of hopelessness and political and geopolitical despair.
I think to truly understand where he's coming from with that, you have to read him into Reinhold Niebuhr, who, of course, you know, an American reform theologian that was hugely influential on King. And King, Niebuhr talked about a sublime madness to love our enemies. And Niebuhr had been on an interesting journey himself from someone who had embraced socialism, had tried to look at a rapprochement with Russia, who had rejected liberalism to later come to a more chastened accommodation with liberalism himself. And I think if we read King through Niebuhr, we still come back to what I think has proved to be a flaw in the King vision, that his appeal to the story of the Good Samaritan is still aimed at redeeming a political liberalism that he believes has redemption in it. It is a shaky foundation of an epistemology of justice that emerges through the history that he talks about, from the Greeks through to the Romans, through to the emergence of the modern world. It's located in what Niebuhr said about the necessity for democracy. Man's capacity for justice makes democracy possible, but man's inclination to injustice makes democracy necessary. Now, if we read the parable of the Good Samaritan and King's evocation of that into that statement from Niebuhr, I think we still arrive back at a man whose vision has not stood the test of time. His irrational appeal to the sublime madness of love rejects the rationality of violence that puts a Donald Trump in the White House and celebrates 250 years of modern America with a fistfight on the White House lawn. Even if you look at where black movements have moved since then to a power-based relationship. You know, as they said during Black Lives Matter, this is not your grandparents' civil rights movement. And let's not remember, it wasn't that he was not aware of the currents, because we'd had the post-World War II rise of Frankfurt School critical theory. We'd seen people pushing back against Enlightenment progressivism. The moral arc of the universe bending toward justice had been obliterated in the Holocaust and in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. He'd seen this in Vietnam. He said the bombs falling in Vietnam will fall in our own cities. There was a contradiction and a paradox at the heart of the King vision, that he appealed to the sublime madness of the parable of the Good Samaritan, but as a way of reforming the rational violence and coercion of a liberal system that has proved that it does not bend to the justice that he sought.
The arc, though, is long. I think that needs to be remembered.
Very, very and long. How long? I mean, that's a question.
Sure, and that's an open question. And look, the idea that the arc bends towards justice inevitably is not a vision I share at all. And I agree, that's a liberal conception of things. And so, yes, those sort of elements are clear. But I don't know that the ravages along the way, the backsliding, the whatever necessarily would have, in his mind at least, vitiated the whole
because of his Protestantism, I think, that you identified earlier. Yes.
And also, we don't need to get into all the academic arguments about it, but there are academic arguments that connect liberalism specifically to Protestantism, that it is an outgrowth.
It is. Know,
which is partly why a lot of the backlash against liberalism of this century has come from conservative Catholics. Mm-hmm. There's a kind of, it's Catholically informed.
Deneen
it's Catholically,
and
yeah, I don't know if Catholically is an advert, but you know what I mean. I think those things are there. But at the same time, I mean, the idea that his vision and his approach has these flaws that are revealed and lies discredited, particularly because of the way in which racial politics has evolved to a more power-based, critical race theory-informed approach. Well, I don't know that Martin Luther King would be in any way perturbed by that. I think he could well stand on his mountaintop, look at that and say, yeah, but what did that achieve?
And what's the
symbiotic relationship between that and the fact that you have Trump in the White House for the second time and so on and so forth.
And as Scott said, you know, Stokely Carmichael was still listening to Martin Luther King Jr. I really like, when I thought about this today, I thought, who are the bookends spiritually of the struggle of the 20th century? If I take MLK and his Protestant vision, founded in this liberalism on the one hand, and John Paul II on the other, with a Catholic vision and speaking back in to Poland and solidarity, there is a fundamental difference, I think, that certainly I would be more theologically on the side of John Paul II than the liberal Protestant vision of Martin Luther King Jr. And it is this, that when King talks of a despair not only in the world but within, John Paul II speaks back to a despair in the world with the spirit within. And it's a fundamental theological difference between a Protestant, and particularly a liberation theology idea, of supernaturalizing the natural, or rather naturalizing the supernatural. And the naturalizing of the supernatural, the idea that you can bring God into redeeming this liberal project, or a John Paul II view that says the spirit is greater than this, and he is never spiritually broken within. And the way that John Paul II stands astride the 20th century and speaks back to the oppression of communism in his own birthplace versus the way that King is buried within the 20th century. And if I'm looking for a vision that takes us into what the world requires now, I look more to the John Paul II vision of a spirit above that than one buried within it and broken within it and still making appeals to try to redeem that liberal progressivism that his Protestantism would never allow him to betray.
You're listening to The Minefield on ABC Radio National. That is the voice of Stan Grant, who, of course, you already know and love, author, theologian, distinguished professor at Charles Sturt University. Waleed Ali is my name. Scott Stevens is my co-host. Is there not an argument, though, Stan, that Martin Luther King Jr. would be well entitled to make? It's like, yeah, but the adoption and the redemption, if you like, of not just this liberal paradigm, but of the national imaginary of the United States did achieve quite stunning landmarks a matter of years ago. And so why would I not believe that it'll do so again? I mean, here is a track record of very recent moment and very recent memory. Why not place our faith in that?
I don't think, if you look at what were his final words, America may go to hell, that he believed that even himself then.
Don't you? I read that as being more of that approach, that there are standards that we hold in common, that we should hold ourselves to them, therefore, and that we should judge ourselves by them. And then if we don't rectify ourselves with reference to those common standards, then we will go to hell.
I think, again, the premise, the universalizing premise of those common standards are not capacious enough to speak to the oppression that had been inflicted on people by the spread of those so-called universal standards. And one of the things that we've seen in more recent times is emergence, which is largely underappreciated, under-researched in the West, but in Africa, of an emergent modernity that does not see in the rupture, in the colonization and the giving up of something to be converted into something else or redeemed into something else, but actually says there is the possibility of what existed before redeeming and civilizing a colonized modernity. I think that is a much more interesting thing for me than just going back to the very shaky foundations of a universalism that had proved to be oppressive to so many people in the world. It's also interesting, if I look at it through the prism of being an Aboriginal person, I mean, there was no greater symbol of justice, and particularly for Aboriginal people of faith, as my family were, than Martin Luther King Jr. And you know, he was revered in our own house. But if I look at America, there is much more for me in the Native American experience, which sits outside the liberalizing, progressive redemption of America that King still fundamentally believed in, than there is in the King vision. Native Americans are outside of that entirely and are still to this day speaking back into that world and on the margins of that. And I don't think King and that vision speaks to those margins. I don't think it's capacious enough. And I think it's founded fundamentally in a shaky foundation of universalism that does not speak to the full weight of oppression that people have suffered because of the spread of that, of those universal ideas. But I do want to come to what I think actually makes this a memorable speech. And what redeems the speech and what goes beyond what I think is a shaky foundation and even a shaky application of the Good Samaritan parable is the last bit of the speech. And something happens. There is a moment when the Holy Spirit takes hold of him. What we hear in that prophecy, what we hear in that I may not get there with you, what we hear in I have been to the mountaintop is something that breaks with the speech itself and delivers it to something beyond the world. And again, to come back to that theological difference between a Protestantism of being in the world or a Catholicism of beyond the world, he reaches beyond that at that point. And that's what electrifies the speech. That's what people remember from the speech. It was interesting with King because so many of his speeches could be discursive and turgid. Even the famous I Have a Dream speech, it was Mahalia Jackson who got tired of the sermonizing and said, tell them about the dream, Dr. King. That's when he rises to the occasion. And it's the same thing in this. The crowd that Scott identifies as willing him on, he stops in mid-sentence, he loses himself in thought, and I think something transcendent happens. That's where it comes alive for me much more than in the liberal progressive Protestantism that
informs much of it. But it's interesting to say that because the promised land surely is the fulfillment of that liberal vision, isn't it?
No, I don't think so. And I don't think the promised land's America. I think he has gone beyond that.
Really? Why do you think that?
Because I think there is a promised land that goes beyond the world informed by our rationality, our vision of the world. I think it's a supernatural moment. And I think it is a mysticism that certainly in Catholicism is the heart of it, but not in Protestantism. And I think there is a mystical moment that transcends that speech from the possibilities of America to the possibilities of God working in the human being. I think he's transformed.
I'm prepared to accept that something supernatural was going on at that point. I just think it's entirely consistent with his Protestantism. I just don't see a basis for reading it differently to that.
I'm with Stan that there is a moment of freedom here that needs to be marked and needs to be marked quite precisely. But I think we may be disagreeing on what that moment of freedom is. Do you remember a little bit earlier in the speech, he's trying to tell those gathered in Memphis that their struggle is going to be of a piece with the struggle that in 1963 in Birmingham against Bull Connor. He says, you know, Bull Connor turned the dogs on us. He turned the hose on us. But there is something that he didn't understand. He says he knew a kind of physics, talking about Sheriff Bull Connor. He knew a kind of physics, but that kind of physics, here I'm quoting King, that somehow didn't relate to the transphysics that we knew about. And he goes on to say, and that was the fact that there's a certain kind of fire that no water could put out. Now, there he's simply referring to the determination of a collective people, but not a collective in general, or a vague collective, but rather this people gathered in this place in the face of this threat, singing together these hymns. In other words, it is proximity, it is collectivity, it is the joining of voices together that expresses that inner spiritual fire. I just find it remarkable, Stan, that the moment that King breaks off, he's done talking, and there's something kind of remarkable about his resonance, his rhythm. He will begin the next sentence at the end of a sentence. If I had sneezed, then he lets them respond, and then he gives an indication where he's going to go. But this is rehearsed. I mean, you can find the same thing in other speeches. And he begins to say, so he's referring to, you know, he got stabbed. If he had sneezed, the thing would have punctured his heart. And they were telling me, and then he just kind of drifts. But it doesn't matter now, is what he says. It doesn't matter now. He talks about the threat.
I think that's a moment of transcendence.
Yes.
It doesn't matter now. And what he's transcended is the sublime madness to love your enemies and the irrationality of nonviolence in a country where the rationality of violence has defined the nation, the genocide of Native Americans, the enslavement of people, Revolutionary War, Civil War, the struggle between the good and bad angels of the nation.
Sure,
but
sure.
He transcends that, I think. And I think he reaches beyond the confines of America or liberalism as a promised land to something that is more ephemeral, that speaks to what John Paul does speak to in Poland.
True. But I think this transcendence is also going in two directions. One is, can we please return to the fact that he is here demonstrating on behalf of sanitation workers? When he argues for proximity to the man lying beaten on the road, he is arguing for closeness. And the people that he's arguing for closeness and solidarity with, again, not as some kind of vague thing. This is very much John Paul II. John Paul II's personalist view, not allowing the sanctity, the sacredness of human bodies to be overwhelmed by the broad sweeps of either politics or states or Hegelian visions of culture. King is here arguing for a proximity to those who smell, those who were repulsive, those who stunk. He's arguing here for a radical, you could even refer to it as a kind of transcendental proximity to those who need to be closest to us. And when he's talking about a march on Washington, he's talking about those poorest people going to the heart of power. In other words, it was the safe distance of legislation that had kept the moral reality of stinking people at bay from effete liberal northern sensibilities. And then when he's referring freedom from fear. So here you have a kind of a double transcendence, a transcendence of both the fear of violence from the world, but also a transcendence of those kind of that innate repulsiveness that causes us to resile from the moral reality of others.
And a repudiation of the Hillary Clinton to come, who would dismiss people like that as deplorables.
That's right.
And isn't it interesting when you look at how it ages, the sanitation workers that he's appealing to are the people dying of deaths of despair during the Obama period, when Obama saves the bankers but people lose their homes.
Right.
The deterioration of the moral vision of King by the very people who laid claim to being the people who were following the moral vision. You know, Obama is sworn in on King's Bible, and he saves the bankers. The sanitation workers who may be voting today for Donald Trump and turning on to watch a fist fight on the White House lawn tells you something about the rationality of violence and the contamination at the heart of American progressive liberalism that turns back in on itself, that King was wrestling with and trapped within, that led to so much of that despair.
Well, happy 4th of July, Stan.
Well, I'm on that note. Listen, there's a lot of good things about America that we didn't get to, and thank God we had a Dr. King.
Indeed. Always wonderful to have you on.
Thank you very much.
Stan Grant, theologian, distinguished professor at Charles Sturt University, author most recently of When Words Fail Us, Truth Beyond Time, and of course he is at Charles Sturt University, I should have pointed out, director of Injamara Ngulawai. Our guest for this week's edition of The Mindfield. We'll be back next week, and you can listen to us on the radio then or anytime you like on ABC Listen. See ya.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.